We often hear from you about how much you enjoy our wildlife shows, especially as the seasons change from winter to spring. I think it's a great time to chat with Scott Craven. Scott's an emeritus professor from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. He's been coming to our program regularly for many, many years, and it's always great to have him back with us again to talk about what's going on in the world of wildlife. And Scott, great to see you.
It's great to be here, and it was great to see the weather forecast this morning.
Oh, yeah, a little cold today, but, you know, there's some warmer weather on the way.
Yes, it's going to be nice, so I think the onset of spring or spring-like conditions will be shortly upon us. I mean, here it comes. There'll be lots of things for people to look for, and people will be happy about being freed up from essentially confinement. I mean, February was brutal.
Yeah, it terrible.
Bad.
Very bad.
It's a time when folks can watch for the events that normally show up on a phenological record. We've talked before about phenology, the study of the timing of natural mm-hmm. events, usually applied to spring, but not necessarily so. And people can keep their own records over the years. When do you hear that first cardinal singing? When's the first robin show up in the backyard? The male red-winged blackbirds, cranes going over, all that stuff that people come to associate with spring. And even some things that have been happening for the last month or so, mm-hmm. some of the birds nesting, the websites, the webcams are already up and have been for some time on the eagles. And the owls and coyotes and fox and other things have been involved in their breeding activity for some time. But bottom line is, it's right around the corner, and I don't think for most people it could come soon enough.
You are right about that. Well, yeah, we've got some pretty good news to share, or interesting news about the Wisconsin elk herd. What's going on there?
Well, the big news on that front, of course, the original restoration effort that started back in 1995 up around Clam Lake in northwestern Wisconsin has been going on. Been lots of study, lots of anguish about how quickly or not so quickly the herd's been growing, with a lot of people watching for that trigger point in herd growth that would allow some sort of limited hunting opportunity. But there's certainly been a lot of public interest in the elk program. They're big, they're beautiful, they're very charismatic. And the fact that that herd wasn't perhaps growing as quickly as people had hoped, I think was one of the driving forces between the idea of, well, let's establish a second recovery or restoration site. This one further south, down around Black River Falls, Jackson County, and a partnership emerged, largely with the cooperative effort with the DNR, of course, but the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation mm-hmm. Was behind a lot of fundraising and promotion and other local groups, including some of the tribes and so forth. Anyway, a lot of people came together and said, hey, let's try it again in another location. And fortunately, a source population was readily available in Kentucky, where their elk restoration efforts just went nuts.
Ballooned.
Just went crazy. So lots of elk in the coal country in western Kentucky, and they agreed to provide, I think the agreement was for up to 150 animals over the next 3 years, roughly 50 a year. And Wisconsin dispatched teams of our wildlife managers down there to work with the Kentucky folks and actually capture the animals. And I think capture has been terminated for this winter. It was kind of an open winter down there, I guess. There were a couple of factors that led to not catching quite as many animals as they might have with the allowable 50. I think the number came in at 28, which they're pretty happy with. And those animals will be headed up here before too long. I think they're well into a 30-day quarantine period in a pen in Kentucky where they're closely monitored for health issues and general condition. Then they'll be brought to Wisconsin, and then there's another, I think, 90-day quarantine or observation period before they're actually released. And I think all of these animals are destined for the new site in Jackson County. And then up to 75, I think, of the 150 have been dedicated to the new Jackson County site, and the rest will be used to augment the population up around Clam Lake. So hopefully within the next 2 or 3 years, Clam Lake will get a boost, a new site will take off, and the elk restoration program will be
moving right along.
Off and moving right along.
And so. We wanted this program, or there's a lot of interest in this program, I think based partly on the history. I mean, we at one point had an elk herd in Wisconsin.
We had an elk herd. They're actually a widely distributed animal. I think many people are surprised to hear that, Kentucky's got lots of elk? How can this be? But they do, and in Michigan, the original elk that we got back in the mid-90s came from the lower peninsula of Michigan. So they're all around us, and we've certainly got the habitat. We have the tradition for these kinds of restoration programs to bring back native species, and hopefully this will be a shot in the arm for it.
What about their comparison? Can we make a comparison to white-tailed deer as far as range and behavior, diet, that sort of thing?
Well, they're a big member of the deer family.
Right,
they
obviously
look to many people like a really big deer, but their behaviors are a little different. Some of the things they do that deer don't, like bugling during the breeding season, is one of the attractions. People really get excited about hearing that sound.
Yeah.
And they're very spectacular.
It's pretty cool.
The antlers on the bulls are spectacular. They seem to stay put. At least the good news is, hopefully this will be the case around the Jackson County site as well, but they tended to stay put where they were released around Clam Lake. Not in the field they were perhaps put in, but in the general area, which was good news. There was some concern that, holy cow, they'd take off and all of a sudden they'd be 100 miles away in somebody's cornfield, which no one wanted, and that puts them vulnerable to vehicle collisions and assorted other things. So they've proven to be a bit of homebodies, but they've certainly had all the characteristics that people hoped for in terms of their attractiveness. So it was apparently not that difficult to garner the public support for this new effort.
There were some mixed feelings.
I think there are folks involved in commercial elk farming in the area who are a bit anxious about the notion of bringing in wild animals, even with the extensive quarantine periods, because they're perhaps worried about disease issues. But from what I understand, every possible precaution is being taken to prevent those kinds of concerns. And the operation in Kentucky was done very efficiently at a very low cost compared to what could have been done. And our own people were down there overseeing it. And so far, things are looking pretty good.
Pretty good. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest, emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology with UW-Madison and University of Wisconsin Extension. Great to have him along. I haven't given the number. Let me do that now. If you have a question or comment or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or, post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your photos, wildlife photos, question or comment there. We had a couple of questions relating to the elk. Steve wondered about the mechanics of moving the elk. Are they sedated to be moved, or what do they do?
Well, I think you look toward their long history of livestock operations around the country, and they'll be transported in vehicles. And I don't know that any necessary sedation may be an issue. They're confined, and it's not that they're, running around in the back of a truck. But
no.
in the heyday of the deer and elk farming industry, which is still going on, it took a bit of a hit with the outbreak of chronic wasting disease. But the mechanics of moving those animals around the country, same way you move a racehorse or any horse or a cow or anything else, pretty well figured out.
Sue wondered about how easy it is to see elk in Clam Lake, and I've got to tell a story that Judith Sears Poisson told me. Last year, she was up with her husband in the area. They stopped to talk to somebody and said, where would we see the elk? And the person said, well, I saw them here this morning, here, over here, and over here. And he drew a map, and she said, we went to those three spots, and they were at every spot.
There they were.
at every one of the spots.
Well, sometimes
you're
better,
lucky.
Better to be lucky than good. We had a similar experience driving up to the Wildlife Society conference in Duluth a couple weeks ago with my traveling companion, and said, "Yeah, I'd like to see one of these snowy owls that's around," and everybody's reporting them. And we were up by the Central Wisconsin Airport near Mosinee, just coming up on that hill, and I saw, "Oh, this is a nice open spot. This would be a good spot to see one." In fact, hey, there's one on top of that service building. Bird was sitting there, and that worked out to be pretty impressive, too. So
there you go.
It happens. On the other hand, you can go somewhere where you think you're going to see species X, Y, or Z, and look high, low, and everything in between, and never find the darn thing. So
I was with a large group of people, and we wanted to see a moose in northern Michigan, or northern Minnesota. And there were just a few of us who were intrepid enough to go with a guide out into the fields, and we tromped and tromped and tromped, and the rest of the people just went on some sort of bus tour. Anyway, we didn't see any. We got back on the bus tour. People said, "Oh, yeah, they were right along the road." Oh, man. Can't win for losing sometime. Gary in Ween is up with a question or comment. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry and Scott. Love the show. Listen all the time. I lived in north central Wisconsin, and the village of Edgar has a Scotch Creek Preserve going to the east of it along the Scotch Creek, and I've been out there snowshoeing down on the ice. And I've come across, now there's five different spots where there'll be a hole going down either into the ice or into the bed of the creek bed.
Yeah.
It'll be about, maybe 6 inches wide, and the scat that's left out on the bed of the creek is like cylindrical, and it has a lot of white lines in it, and I was just wondering if what I'm seeing is otters.
Well, it certainly could be. I mean, does it appear that there were that the holes were actually chewed in the ice?
It's sort of like where the ice meets the bank of the creek, and the water level has dropped in the creek over winter.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
So, yeah, it's certainly possible that you're seeing otter, although otter sign beyond the droppings in terms of slides and tracks and so forth are pretty obvious, too, if the animals are out and about.
There's one place where there's two slides.
It's got to be otter.
Then I think you're seeing otter sign.
Sure. And the other thing we have in the preserve is a barred owl, and it's been fantastic. We've had quite a few people seeing it, and some have even named it Edgar after the preserve. But it must have a wingspan over 3 feet, and I've been very fortunate to have seen it a couple times. Once from a distance of about 50 feet, and I was skiing, I just stopped, and we eyeballed each other for about 5 minutes, and then it just dropped from the tree to a height of about 8 feet and glided through the trees. It was just awesome.
They're pretty tolerant of people, and they're also very communicative. Their calls are really neat, and the who cooks for you call is easy to imitate. And if you listen to a recording of that and practice a little bit, you can get pretty good at it pretty quickly, and they'll often talk back and forth with you too, so maybe you can establish a dialogue with that owl. It'll be good.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest, talking the wonderful world of wildlife. Join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. I'm Larry Mealer. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mealer here with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Kay in Marshfield has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Kay.
Hello. Tell me why the elk, all the effort gone into producing their antlers every year, why can't they keep them? Why are they shed? Goats don't, and male cows and stuff, once they grow them, they don't shed them.
Yeah.
Well, they also don't have antlers. They have horns.
Yeah.
And there's a difference. Oh. So a horn, a true horn, like a pronghorn antelope or a cow or goat or whatever, there's a bony core in the center of that horn, and then the sheath on the outside, which is hollow and it adheres to the bone, is essentially a keratin-like material like your fingernails.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see if you have a set of cow horns or something for decorative purposes or whatever, or if you think about a powder horn that mm-hmm. the old mountain men used to carry,
yep.
that was the hollow sheath of a horn, and they could use it to store powder in. Whereas an antler is entirely bone, and the growth starts from the little pedestal on each side of the top of the skull, and all that new bone growth grows. It's nourished by the vascular tissue we know of as velvet, that soft, fuzzy stuff that you see on a buck early in the season, mm-hmm. on a deer or an elk. And the bone grows, and all of a sudden, once growth is finished, they rub that velvet off, and the bony structure is left behind. Its real purpose is for display and defense and squabbling over property rights during the breeding season. And once that rut or breeding season is over with and we start to get into winter, by now, although I still hear few reports of bucks carrying antlers, most have been long since dropped. They don't need them. They don't need to lug that apparatus around if they're not using it for the breeding season, and a lot of them get damaged, and it's over over evolutionary time, it's become advantageous to develop this deciduous nature of antlers so that they're shed and dropped, and they grow new ones. The other advantage, of course, is that, as you know, with deer antlers, their size, which is what drives many deer hunters, mm-hmm. is determined by a couple of different factors, most notably the age of the deer. So a young buck that just has a little spike, if they were like cows and maintained those, once they grew that little spike, he'd be stuck with those little spikes for the rest of his life. Whereas as they progress through time, the older, more mature animals grow a bigger rack, and that then leads to them doing most of the breeding. And from a genetic standpoint, it all works out. But the basic difference is antlers are bone and deciduous, horns are not.
There you go. Thanks, Cave. Thank you very much for calling. Good, good question, and by the way, a good answer. That was well said, Scott. Jeff in Flambeau Flowage has a question. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Larry and Scott. My wife and I were just devastated when we heard about this reduced power of Aldo Leopold's Natural Resource Board going from governing to advisory. And this big reduction in the budget, the governor's budget, to reduce funding for science services and environmental education. And I wonder if Scott could kind of explain to us all, you know, what is the status right now? And those of us that disagree with what's going on, if there's a forum or anything we can do about it.
Well, thank you for the question, Jeff. I'm glad you asked it, but in other ways, I kind of wish you hadn't, because it's a very challenging issue to address. And lots of folks who are concerned about the conservation heritage in Wisconsin and the Leopold legacy and the long history that Wisconsin has as a leader in conservation and fish and wildlife management, forestry, endangered resources, and so forth. We hate to see that threatened. The three big things you touched on, the impacts on the stewardship fund, which I think could delay any further land purchases until well into the 2020s, I don't fully understand or appreciate what that decision has to do with debt service, but what I understand is that the basic concept that they're not making any more land, and as prime pieces become available to be essentially saddled with no opportunity here for quite a long period of time, is going to mean that many opportunities go by the boards, and those lands will pass to something else, not likely perhaps something that conservation-minded people would like to see happen. So the stewardship issue is one. The cuts to science services that are proposed are especially perplexing, because I think everybody, I hope, although there's some sense that maybe science doesn't get the respect that it once had and deserves as being the driving force behind decision making, that's one problem, that then is crippled. But what causes me the most anxiety is that at least some of those positions that are targeted are funded with Pittman Robertson funds and federal, essentially federal pass-through dollars that come from, if you know about the Pittman Robertson Fund, it's been in place for many, many years. It's a prime driver behind many aspects of conservation, shooting ranges and hunter education and wildlife research. It's called the Federal Aid to Wildlife Restoration. It's the formal name, but it's known as PR. And that comes from the excise tax on guns and ammunition. And, of course, over the last few years, because there's been a lot of anxiety about potential federal movement to limit access to guns and or ammunition, there's been a lot of purchasing going on. And every time you buy a gun, 11% excise tax is applied. That's collected by the federal government.
And ammunition,
then,
too.
And ammunition, too. And then that's doled back out to the states on a formula basis. And Wisconsin fares very well in the formula because, in part, the number of hunters we have in the state. So lots of money's been coming in. Some of that money is used to fund these researchers and their work. And therefore,
why would you?
Why? I don't understand the logic in, well, first of all, cutting science services badly like this is, at least to me, ill-advised for conservation and for driving the research that informs our deer management, all the big deer projects that are going on, and a host of other things that these folks do. And when they're paid by federal dollars, where's the savings to the state? Okay, you know, I've heard rumors about other reasons driving this cut, but you'll have to get your information on that from the papers. That's where I'm forced to get most of mine. The Natural Resources Board is perhaps the most egregious of the whole thing, because this is our fail-safe group that takes up regulations and rule changes and passes this on to the DNR and to eliminate that rulemaking process or circumvent it and vest it in, I guess it would be the governor's office, as opposed to a group of presumably folks who were appointed because of their skills, talents, and interests in conservation and related natural resources fields is really bad news. I mean, it's bad enough we've had trouble getting the secretary appointed as they used to be by the NRB. That's another long-going issue. But to reduce them to an advisory capacity, really, you know, another advisory group. We have the Conservation Congress, the NRB. There are all sorts of people giving advice. Advice is cheap, but to have some teeth behind the advice and decisions of the NRB is where the importance really lies. So I guess, Jeff, your original question is what's the status of all this? All I can say is I believe it's still a work in progress. I don't think the budget is finalized or approved in any way. I don't know exactly what the timetable is on that. But these things are clearly on the table, and they've attracted a lot of attention. What to do is another matter. It is a democracy. I mean, you're free to contact your representatives. Groups like the League of Conservation Voters are having rallies and so forth discussing some of these issues. But there are lots of conservation organizations, including one that I'm involved with, who are really struggling with where's the pressure point? Where can you really make any headway on this? Because hand-wringing and that kind of thing isn't going to cut it. There have been lots of good summaries in some of our media outlets. There was a particularly nice one dealing with all three of these aspects prepared by George Meyer, former secretary of the DNR, which was in Wisconsin Outdoor News just a week or 10 days ago. That's the newspaper format, outdoor, biweekly outdoor publication. There are some sources like that that I think can address more detail than we've got time to do on the program. And this is all just the very idea that it's being thought about is kind of painful. Yeah. The thought that it could come to fruition is almost too painful to think about, yeah. But I don't know what can be done about it.
Scott Craven, our guest, wildlife ecologist at the UW-Madison, emeritus professor. Great to have him along to talk about the world of wildlife. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and with your comments. We did have, I want to go back to an elk question or two. Jim wonders why has the, and from Bayfield wonders, why has the elk population declined here in the state?
Well,
really hasn't declined.
It really hasn't declined. I mean, it declined to zero.
Yeah.
And of course, there were lots of factors involved in that many, many years ago. But the restoration effort in the Clam Lake herd started out with 25 animals. It's somewhere around 160 now, give or take, and there'll be calves added to the population here before too long, so it'll take its seasonal boost. It's not a matter of declining as much as it is. It just hasn't grown at the rate or of a magnitude that they had hoped for and
yeah.
perhaps expected. And those factors involved have been highway mortality, predation, some issues with feeding and a few other a variety of things going on that have just limited the growth of that herd. And that's one of the reasons why there's an effort going to establish another one and see what happens there.
Let's turn to E. Jane in Appleton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. How do dogs get along with coyotes and red foxes? Because I sometimes have to take care of three golden retrievers, and we've seen them right on the borderline outside the yard. And it's 5 acres, and they're kind of in the farmland. And I was wondering if there's fights or if they would hurt the dogs or what.
Red fox, I don't think, would be much.
I wouldn't be too concerned about the fox. Fox in the pecking order are probably, the fox themselves are more concerned about the coyotes and the threat they pose to the fox than they are about dogs. And a lot of fox have been attracting a lot of publicity lately, even right here in Madison on campus, with a resident fox population here in an urban landscape, and they seem to do just fine. They're tolerant of people. It maybe gets them away from coyotes out in the hinterland, and they're doing okay. Coexistence with foxes is a little easier. Coyotes are a bigger potential issue because particularly with smaller dogs. Golden retrievers, which I think you mentioned, are pretty good-sized animals, and you mentioned three of them. You know, three golden retrievers in a group would be a formidable front. But a schnauzer or a toy poodle or any of the many small breeds of dogs that people have, there certainly are ample documented cases of coyotes taking those animals, literally in some cases, right out of a backyard and killing them. And that, for obvious reasons, causes great anxiety on the part of the pet owner and in part of the neighborhood, community, or what have you. So there's a fair bit of concern about that, and people need to be vigilant and keep their dogs under watch. And if coyotes are around, be even more vigilant. Larger dogs, there have been over the years lots of examples of people with home videos of their dogs seemingly playing with coyotes and frolicking in the yard. You know, what the coyotes' intentions are sometimes a little questionable. But generally speaking, you need to be cautious in any case, but you need to be especially cautious if you have small pets.
Yeah.
Not only dogs, but cats as well.
Yep, there you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Lee in Green Bay next. Lee, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I just had a question. Scott already answered it on the elk population up at Clam Lake, about 160, he said.
Yeah.
Okay, but my real question is, what has happened, because I've got property up in the Tomahawk area, a large parcel, what's happened to our snowshoe hares? Where have our snowshoe hares gone?
Well, they're two things there, and I'm trying to remember which issue was it. I try and keep up on a variety of different publications, and either in Wisconsin Natural Resources, the DNR magazine, or in Outdoor News, within the last month or two, there was a nice article about a research project that had revisited a number of the sites that had been studied back in the 80s, I believe, in terms of snowshoe hare distribution in the state. And it showed very nicely that areas on the southern fringe of Snowshoe Range, right through central Wisconsin, a large percentage of them now did no longer had snowshoe hares. So that the range of those animals was retreating to the north, and it was very visible on the map. And number two, of course, the other issue is snowshoe hares are cyclic, like ruffed grouse, and in a down year, or a number of down years, it's a 10-year cycle, they're a whole lot less abundant than they are in a population peak. And they tend to follow slightly behind the grouse peak, and we're kind of going downhill to the bottom on grouse, so I'd expect the same thing in snowshoe hares. So I think the answer, Lee, is twofold. Number one, they're probably at a cyclic or periodic not necessarily a low, but a low point, maybe even going lower. But beyond the influence of that, their range has been retracting north. And I just can't find in my pile. Well, Larry can attest to that. I got a pile of newspapers and magazines here.
I think
here.
It was in the Natural Resources magazine.
I want to say it was in the DNR magazine, too, but it was a very nice report on that study on revisiting historically occupied snowshoe hare range and finding that they were gone.
And that's DNR research.
Yeah. I think it was a university.
Or it may have been a UW.
I think it was a university project, probably in conjunction with the DNR, and I just don't
happen to have it right
on this one.
Well, while you're looking, I want to switch gears here and go to, and Lee, thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Michael in Washburn next. Michael, hi. Thank you for calling.
Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning.
And by the way, if you do find that reference to the snowshoe hare, I'd be interested. Put it on your Facebook or something?
Yeah, we can put it up.
Okay.
That'd be great. Send me the research. Scott has been to my home between the Sioux and the Onion River. We have the program out there, Scott, the Natural Branch of Learning. You visited.
Oh, I remember that. Yes, very nice place.
Sure. Yeah, hi. So I've got a wolf dynamic. Actually, it's a canid dynamic happening. In the years that we've lived here, over 20, and as the wolf population has grown, infrequently I would see a single wolf track in the snow around the winter. Oh, not often, a week, every 2 weeks, something like that. In the last 2 years, the frequency has increased. This year, I see new wolf tracks every day. And this is anecdotal, but the coyote population, as far as tracks go and hearing them call, has dropped. Interestingly, mm-hmm. the red fox population has increased.
Mm-hmm.
And the deer last year did not frequent or yard in our swamp like they usually do, and probably because it was so incredibly deep in snow. I don't know where they yarded at. Well, there weren't any deer last year. So, but this year they're in the swamp much more readily and yarding like they typically do. But I can't figure out. I'm seeing 3 and 4 different sets of wolf tracks every week. In fact, I've got a large dog, and I walk him on a leash. And we saw 2 nights ago, we jumped a wolf in the... Well, we didn't jump him. We walked through a meadow and then through a balsam brush area and popped out into a pine plantation where he had been sitting. He ran off. I saw him leave. And the whole time we were in the meadow, he was sitting there watching us. So, and this is not a threat situation or anything,
right.
But it's just interesting that they are frequent enough in that area. They used to be up in the up by the Little Sioux, up in the hills, and they seem to have moved the range, at least for the winter down there. So it's more of an observation. If you have comments on it, I'd be interested.
Okay.
Well, your observations, I think, although they're anecdotal in your view, are supported by many other people
yeah.
observing the same basic things in many places, and one being the hierarchy that has been known for a long time among our canids, which is wolves at the top of the heap, coyotes in the middle, and the poor old red fox at the bottom of the heap. So you're right, and I think there's documentation available that, you know, wolves will displace or squeeze the coyotes a bit, and that in the long run that's a good thing for the fox. As far as the deer are concerned, Larry can attest,
yes.
as can a number of other folks in the North Woods, in the deer hunting framework and the, you know, the kind of constant give and take between the deer hunters and wolves and what the heck's going on. There's it's not a matter of necessarily the wolves eating all the deer in a given area and therefore hunters reporting, hey, there's no deer. I think the deer have figured out that it's in their best interest
to move somewhere else
away from an area of high wolf activity. And therefore, the deer move around, and depending on snow depth affecting yards or wolf activity, they may be here one year and somewhere else the next year. So the dynamic that you're able to observe on your property is typical of what's going on across northern Wisconsin, and it's a neat thing to be part of. And the fact that you occasionally get to see a wolf as well as the fresh sign, you know, some people are pretty excited about that. Some people are pretty excited about it for very different reasons. But your observations are consistent with the observations of many other folks up there. So,
yep.
Thanks for calling in.
And just a side comment. You know, I find having wolves in our area adds a dimension to being out there.
Yeah.
But I think the human carrying capacity has been met with the wolves. I mean, the ecological carrying capacity, I think we could afford a few more, but it'll be interesting to see where this goes. But I for one, enjoy them. And I got two deer last fall, so there you go.
Well, there you go.
Yeah,
so all's well.
Better than some of us.
All's well that ends well. And if in where this all goes, you were alluding to all of the legal challenges and ups and downs in wolf management, that truly is a confusing mess. But I think most people are aware now that in late December, a federal judge returned the animals in the Great Lakes population to the endangered species list, which derailed the Wisconsin wolf hunting and trapping season, which had been going reasonably well. At least they seem to be very efficiently running it, and quotas were holding things under control. And I think folks who had been previously pretty anxious about wolf numbers felt that they finally had some power to do something, if you will. And the situation seemed to be getting better. And then the federal court intervened and put them back on the endangered species list, and now I see that two states, Wisconsin and Michigan, have joined with the Fish and Wildlife Service in filing appeals to that ruling, and there are also legislators getting involved at the federal level to remove wolves from the Endangered Species Act, basically. So there are a lot of things going on. I don't know how it will play out. I don't think anyone does, but I would really like to see wolf management restored to the states, the local entities who have the animals, and I think have demonstrated the ability to take care of them.
Yeah.
We'll never agree on what the perfect number is for the wolf population, and the notion that this population needs to be more protected so that wolves will extend their range into historical sites in Illinois and Iowa and whatnot. That is not going to happen, no matter how many wolves are housed in northern Wisconsin, Minnesota, or Michigan. So we'll see. Interesting times in wolf management. But
yep, there you have it.
There you have it.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, talking the world of wildlife here in our state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Scott, we were just talking about wolves, and it reminded me that you've got an event coming up that people could participate in.
Yes, that's true, Larry. I can't provide the complete specifics in terms of the costs and so forth, but I can mention the dates at least. And the opportunity is that an old friend of mine, a very talented naturalist and the leader of an operation called Door County Tours out of Bailey's Harbor. Anyway, Paul and I will be leading a tour to Isle Royale in the North Country. The group will convene in Houghton, Michigan, and take the Park Service's boat out to the island, and we will be out there. It's essentially a 7-day adventure. The dates will be August 24th to 30th, this coming August.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, in terms of number of, I know it will obviously be limited in terms of participation, but we'll be out there for quite a while. The lodging is in the Rock Harbor Lodge on the island. It should be really nice, and there'll be opportunity for exploration of the island through hikes and boat trips and free time. Hopefully the Moose Wolf Research Team will be there, and we can talk with them and see a whole variety of things. So it promises to be a pretty neat trip. I'm pretty excited about it in light of our discussion about wolves and their interactions with ungulates like moose and so forth. I think there'll be a lot of people who might be interested. So the bottom line is, I guess if folks have a keen interest in this and finding out the details, which will be on the Door County Tours website probably within the next few weeks, that's one way. Be patient on this. And when I know something more about how to actually sign up, if I'm not on with you, I'll get you the information. And maybe
we'll post it up on our Facebook page.
Yeah, we can put it on the Facebook page. Good idea. So, in the bottom line is August 24th to 30, 7-day adventure to explore Isle Royale, and it should be pretty cool.
That's pretty. And you'll probably be like talking a little bit and serving as a resource. And
I'll be serving as a resource, as will Paul. He's very good on everything from geology to botany to birds and so forth. So for folks who are interested in natural history in general, it should be a pretty neat tour. And it's a pretty neat place.
Yeah, so definitely. We have Vi and Shano, who's been patiently waiting. So let's go to Vi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been waiting for a little while, but I'm patient. Okay, I have a question about the budget. Why has the governor put the DNR in the budget when they don't get any money from the state? It all comes from licenses, like from hunting and fishing and other fees.
Well, I mean, they're in the budget because they're a big state agency, and there's a lot of GPR revenue or general public revenue that goes into funding various aspects of the DNR. You're correct, though, in saying, for example, the Wildlife Fund, which total DNR budget, and there was a nice little flyer about this. It's entitled the 2013-14 Fish and Wildlife Account Annual Report that allows people to see where the money is going. The Fish and Wildlife Account totals about $100 million, which is 17.5% of the total DNR spending. The sources of revenue for the Fish and Wildlife Fund are 65% fishing and hunting licenses and stamps, as you suggested, 12.5% from that Pittman-Robertson Fund I was talking about, federal money, a few minutes ago. The Sport Fish Restoration Fund, which is analogous to PR, another 10% plus. Grants, donations, and other sources, 9%, and the Wildlife Damage Surcharge, 3%, for a total of 100%. So the $100 million Fish and Wildlife Fund is generated from funds that are not GPR, but there is certainly public money, state money, going in to support aspects of the DNR. And then there's a long breakdown in here of where every penny of the typical dollar of that Fish and Wildlife account goes to. 28 cents on the dollar going into wildlife, 19 cents to law enforcement, 26 cents to fisheries, and then the breakdown of particular activities. So you could get a hold of this little brochure if you really want to know where the money comes from and goes.
And get that from the DNR.
Yeah, it was actually, I picked it up at a, where did I pick it up? They have all of their various social media here, and the website dnr.wisconsin.gov is listed. I'm guessing this is probably online. I think I picked it up at one of the outdoor shows over the last few weeks.
Wow, there we go. Vi, thank you so much for calling. It just reminded me, I was thinking about the DNR and various activities that the DNR is involved in. Last night, I took my daughter Emily, who's 11, to we spent 3 hours at a hunter education program in McFarland, Wisconsin, run by the some members, some great guys from the Hope Rod and Gun Club, with strong assistance and education support from the Department of Natural Resources.
Right.
It's a wonderful program to teach young and old, and there were you know, a daughter and mom were there. There was an older guy there who hadn't hunted before. There were, and then a lot of kids, a lot of youngsters, all benefiting from sort of the education efforts of not only the Hope Rod and Gun Club, but the primary education materials came from the DNR.
Yeah, the DNR administers the Honor Education Program, and all these folks from any Rod and Gun Club or volunteers like me and lots of other people who are Hunter Ed instructors are all run through the DNR process and program before we're allowed to do that.
So it's certainly a beneficial program. Carla in Wausau, we turn to you next. Hi, Carla.
Good morning. You had a caller earlier talking about what he could do to, you know, talk about all these cuts to everything. And you had recommended contacting his legislators, which he needs to do, and everybody out there needs to do. Also contact the governor. I would say become involved in a local Sierra chapter, the League of Conservation Voters. Contact the Conservation Congress, Pheasants Unlimited, Ducks Unlimited, Whitetails Forever. Get a hold of some of these groups and become involved in these groups, because these are the groups that make these kinds of things happen. So that's what I'm suggesting. And also the League of Conservation Voters will be having their lobby day in Madison on April 14th. And that's pretty much free. They ask for donations. If you go on the League of Conservation Voters website, you can, click to that and sign yourself up to go. But we meet in the morning, talk about, the goals of the League of Conservation Voters, and then we break out and we go talk to our legislators in the afternoon. So that's a good way for people to make their voices known along with their face in front of their representatives. So that's my suggestions.
Carla, thank you so much. Scott, comment?
Those are great suggestions. The lobby day sponsored by the league is a big event, and if people don't know about that, they ought to go see what it's all about.
Art in the Eagle area, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. My question is, there's a big wetlands called Scuppernog in that area, and they have been clearing it, making it more natural state, getting all the scrub trees out and things like that. And there was an article a couple of years ago stating that they were hoping to put in a herd of either bison or elk. Have you heard anything about that, or is it possible that they could be doing that? I personally would like it, but I'm just curious. That's all the Kettle Moraine Forest right there.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm not that familiar with it. I know of the Scuppernong and the restoration work, but all of those activities have a master plan attached to the restoration and management efforts, which should be available. You can probably find it on the internet, but I wouldn't hesitate to contact the nearest DNR office, either or the Kettle Moraine Administration. Say, hey, I'm kind of curious about what's going on at Scuppernong, and if there's something, there's no elk involved. I don't think that's the case, because we've talked about that, and they've got a destination in mind. The bison issue, I think free-ranging bison, a little sketchy too, unless they've got some sort of a confinement plan. But bottom line is, the master plan for that whole project should be available for you to have a look at, and then you'll know exactly what they're up to and on what timetable.
Yep, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Donna in Delavan, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I read the very informative and entertaining book, Live Arrival Guaranteed, by Hazel St. Germain Grange. And I was who worked on the encouragement of sustaining wildlife in Wisconsin. And the end of the book said that they had given some land called the Sand Hills State Wildlife Area near Babcock. That was for 50 years. Do you know what happened to it? That was last year's year when the 50 years ran out?
Well, the Sand Hill Wildlife Area, Wallace Grange and his wife.
Yes.
Wallace was a big name in Wisconsin conservation.
Yeah.
And
book is fantastic.
The Sand Hill Wildlife Area is still one of the largest properties in the DNR inventory. It is still a state wildlife area. It has a long history of some interesting research programs on the area, dealing with grouse and deer and so forth. One of the cool things about a large chunk of it was that it was fenced. and still is, as far as I know. So the Sand Hill area is alive and well. I don't know about the expiration of an agreement, but I suspect they've done something about that.
Yeah, and, I bet they have.
The Sand Hill Wildlife Area is alive and well and a neat place to visit and look around.
And hopefully and probably going to be there for a long time.
I hope it's there forever, but who knows? It could be, well, I mean, I guess under one proposal I just read about, it could become the whatever wildlife area. Although, I guess that was state parks that they were talking about.
That was state parks they were talking about.
Larry, just if we got just a second here, one thing that someone, either you or someone else mentioned, the Conservation Congress, and I won't be back on in early April, so I just wanted to remind people that the Conservation Congress spring hearings, the annual spring hearings, will be coming up on Monday, April 13th in all 72 counties. There are no real hot controversies this year that I'm aware of, but it still is a chance for anybody to speak out on whatever issues they're concerned about. And Fish and Wildlife Conservation and the questionnaire, the questions that will be addressed and voted on, are available online. There are some that deal with changing the opening hours of the pheasant hunting, turkey hunting opening days in terms of a certain date in April, some possession, a few incidentals,
a few things.
But it's always interesting and it always attracts some crowds in the counties, and that's coming up on April 13th.
We had an email from Jim in Milwaukee who wondered, what's the best time of the day to see the Clam Lake elk herd? Do they run around in the day or are they night? They're around pretty much in the day, I think, for the most part.
Well, they're around. They're big, so if you can find them, they're not that difficult.
You're not going to miss them.
You're not going to miss them, but I think like white-tailed deer or any ungulates, they tend to be active early and late in the day.
Yeah.
And they're there, of course, during the day, but more sedentary and kind of taking a break during midday. So early and late.
Early and late, probably the best. And tell you what, we've got lots more to talk about. Somebody had a question about Wisconsin giving Kentucky ruffed grouse, and we can talk about that. We need to take a look at the news, though, and weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. Scott Craven, our guest, the number for you to call, and we've got open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. News coming up. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist extraordinaire. Great to have him along. Thank you for listening in. Join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got a question or a wildlife experience to share. Got a photo? Post it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I have to ask Cheyenne, have we got anything? Well, she's talking to someone on the phone right now. She can't look at me. But I was going to ask her. We'll have to take a look and see if we got some good wildlife photos. I know there are some up there of snowy owls, for sure. We have a question, an email, actually, from, or actually Facebook question, was from Matt, who wondered, is it true that in the exchange for elk, Wisconsin is giving Kentucky 10,000 ruffed grouse? And I think my answer to that is no. We're not. We couldn't find 10,000 ruffed grouse if we had.
We are going to give them some grouse, I believe,
yeah.
But not 10,000. That would be a Herculean trapping effort. I think the exchange rate back in the original exchange when we... Well, actually, the previous exchange of grouse was for turkey restoration with Missouri, and I think we were swapping 3 grouse for 1 turkey.
Yeah.
Now, I guess if you do it on the basis of poundage, given the size of a bull elk, but I think that there's the number's a lot closer to hundreds than thousands.
Of the hundreds of grouse, not thousands of grouse. All right, let's go to Debbie and Stevens Point. Hi, Deb. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I have kind of an unusual question. We've been out of town, and when I looked into my laundry chute this morning, it's empty, but there was a bat there, and it's not very lively, but it does seem to be alive because it has changed position. Can we put it outside? Will the thing freeze to death? We're really kind of unsure how to handle this.
It's not going to survive outside.
It's not going to survive outside in the next couple of days. I mean, it's going to be bitterly cold, and then Friday things are supposed to turn around, and we're going back above freezing. So, have you removed it from the laundry chute? Or
no.
Okay. Well, you could. I mean, if it's pretty much inactive, you could just scoop it into a cardboard box with a, you know, a small shovel or scoop or whatever.
Okay.
Or put on a glove or use a pair of kitchen tongs, but try not to injure it. I mean, you don't want to give it a big squeeze with a pair of tongs, but with a pair of gloves, you can gently get it into a box with an old towel or some paper towels in there that it can cling to. And just put it in a cool place for a couple of days until it gets above freezing, and then you could think about getting it outside. The problem is if it gets outside and it does take flight, it probably came from your attic or wall spaces anyway, which means you have a small colony, or at least that individual, that was attempting to overwinter in your house. And it may just go right back in the house, and the problem could have you had any indication in the past that you've heard bats or scrambling around in the walls or ceilings or anything else?
No, we haven't.
Well, it's possible it was just an accidental introduction, and you can get it back outside if it gets above freezing. It'll at least have a fighting chance. You can also attempt to track down a wildlife rehabilitator in the Stevens Point area, and I suspect there are a number of them. A local DNR office can perhaps give you a name to go on.
Oh, good. Okay.
And then if somebody who knows a bit more about taking care of them and dealing with it could probably intervene on the bat's behalf as well. But I would be at least a little cautious that you pay some attention if you have an attic. Get up and look around. See if you find any droppings or any other indication that there are bats occupying the wall voids, attic, or whatever, and then take some steps to do the necessary bat-proofing during the summer under guidelines which are available from the DNR, and you can go ahead and eliminate this from happening again.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Deb. Appreciate the call. Kathleen in Stateline, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me? I'm on speaker.
Yes, I can.
Oh, good. I have, sorry to go reiterate and have Scott answer a question. I came in a little late on your wonderful show, and he was talking about Isle Royale.
Yeah.
Was there some contact information how you could arrange to be there? And the date was August, I've forgotten now.
Well, what I was talking about was a tour that I'm involved with in terms of joining a well-known naturalist who runs tours out of his office in Door County, and we'll be leading a tour to Isle Royale August 24th to 30th this coming summer, and it will be a seven-day adventure, for lack of a better term, to explore the wildlife and wilderness on the island, but with the comforts of modern lodging. So we'll be headed out into Lake Superior on the National Park Service boat and headquartered on the island for a few days, and I think it promises to be a great time. All I could say about contact information right now was that we'll get this up on Larry's Facebook page or make an announcement on a subsequent program. The dates are set. The basic plan for the trip is set, but it's not up on Paul's website yet, which is a group called Door County Tours, and therefore I can't give any specific information about reserving a spot and
cost and so forth.
Right.
Yeah, but we'll have that as soon as you have it. Give it to us, and we'll put it up and a link to wherever people need to go.
The website is very easy. It's doorcountytours.com, and eventually it will be on that website.
Doorcountytours.com. There you go, Kathleen. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And we had another question about bobcats. That was from a guy in the Lilly area. Anything about bobcat populations in Wisconsin?
Well, the most notable issue about bobcats is that they're extending their range further south. as are fishers and some other northern animals, into the southwest and elsewhere from central and southwestern Wisconsin. But otherwise, they're doing reasonably well.
They are doing well.
They're okay.
There's Brandon sent us a photo of some dung. I've shown many folks that from people who hunt out west, most have guessed it's elk. And he was listening to the show. We found near Reedsburg. I can't imagine there are elk in Reedsburg. But he said there was a huge bed, and of course he doesn't give us any tracks. It'd be really nice to see tracks.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the track of an ungulate, like an elk or a deer, is very different than, than the track of a canid, like a wolf or whatnot. But it looks like a pile of droppings that were actually pellets, but were coalesced because of the texture of this particular deposit, so to speak, and hadn't fragmented into the individual pellets. So I don't think elk is a likely possibility.
No.
But there's no frame of reference on the photograph, so it's hard to tell whether we're looking at something the size of a golf ball or a basketball.
Yeah.
I can't say, Larry.
And someone else is wondering, here's a really cool set of photos from Nancy, who wonders, she found this, my memory is correct, she found this in her wanderings here in the state somewhere, and wonders what it is, or what kind of animal. It's a skull, obviously. For those who happen to be on Facebook right now, it's a skull with a pretty good set of teeth.
Yeah, it looks like a raccoon skull, actually.
Ah.
So I can't get a good look at it from this distance, but that's given the size of 3 or 4 inches there and what I can see of the dentition, that's what it looks like.
You know, that's a really good, I hate to say guess, but I bet you that's what it is.
Yeah, there's even some fur on that one view that's still adhering to the top of the skull.
It looks like coon. So. Yeah, like raccoon. All right, we've got Nora in Milwaukee next. Hi, Nora.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest a follow-up question when he was talking about wolves and the federal case that added them again to the endangered species list.
Yeah.
Didn't you say that there really is no chance that the wolves will move into Illinois and Iowa and repopulate those areas? And I just wondered why you said that and what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, one of the parts or components of the judge's ruling that led to the judge's determination that these animals were not fully recovered and then therefore warranted continued protection under the Endangered Species Act was that the population had not grown to the point where it could expand and repopulate historic range of wolves in the central part of the United States, which included not only the upper Midwestern states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota, where there are wolves, but also the Dakotas, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, and so on. And I think wolf experts weighed in on this pretty quickly, most notably a couple of folks in Minnesota who are the gurus of wolf management. And although they were willing to acknowledge some potential range expansion, perhaps into the Dakotas, the likelihood that a wolf population, not to say that a wolf might not wander through Iowa, Illinois, or Indiana, and some of our Wisconsin wolves have, but the idea that they're going to establish a population that people would allow to survive is just not going to happen. It's no more likely than that there'll be a population, on the west side of Madison. It's not going to happen, and that seems to be the consensus opinion of the people who know the animals, and I think it's a common sense opinion as well. The environment in states like Illinois and Iowa and so forth is just no longer. It may have been at one point, but it's no longer conducive to a sustaining population of wolves. And that was the contention of the wolf experts who saw that part of the ruling and said, well, this is just not a well-informed decision. So that's where it came from.
Yep, there it is. Thanks, Nora. Dave in Utica, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Scott and Larry. Like so many others, I really appreciate the professional and informative programs that you guys put on.
Thank you.
Scott, I had an encounter, an unusual one, with a wolf a couple summers ago, and I wondered if you could comment on it. This occurred on Highway 51 in adjacent to Trout Lake in northern Wisconsin. It was probably about 10:30 at night. I was driving on Highway 51, and I noticed the car quite a ways ahead of me. The brake lights go on. I slowed down. And as I approached that spot, an animal rushed out at my vehicle from the side of the road. I thought it was perhaps a coyote. I turned around, went back, and then turned around again to go by the same spot. It happened again. And I thought, my gosh, what is that? I turned around one more time. It was standing in the middle of the highway. And then finally, I was able to get it standing on the side of the road. Not 10 yards away, in my headlights, it was undoubtedly a wolf behaving like an ill-mannered dog. I went to the same area the next day thinking there might be a roadkill deer or something like that. I didn't see anything, and I've often wondered if someone like you might comment on behavior like that. It was assuredly a wolf.
Oh.
Well, the behavior you described did exactly sound like an ill-mannered dog from somebody's house nearby that it took a liking to chasing or reacting to vehicles, but that certainly isn't typical wolf behavior. Way back years ago when wolf restoration was being talked about in Wisconsin and they were redoing Highway 53 from, Superior down toward Eau Claire, and there were talks of the design of that highway at the very presence of that road being a potentially a major block or detriment to wolves dispersing from Minnesota over across northwestern Wisconsin just because of the presence of the road, let alone traffic and their fear of cars. So that's certainly atypical. I've never heard of anything like that.
No.
I have any explanation I could give you would be nothing more than speculation that, hey, its mate had been clipped by the car in front of you with lights and it was lying there in the ditch and the other animal was attacking what it perceived as a threat. I mean, I don't know. But
even that's a pretty good guess.
Well, I really just don't have anything other than speculation. But the folks who are up there in the North Woods and have a lot more to do with the animals than I do, folks like Dave McFarland, who heads up the wolf program for the DNR. Now, I would, try and send them an email or describe the situation to them, and then Dave can check with some of the other folks like Adrian Weideman, who's now retired, and see if they've ever heard of such an incident and have any kind of an explanation for it.
Yeah.
But I don't.
I never heard of it either. Thanks, Dave, for calling. And it'd be fun. Adrian often listens. He could phone. Adrian, if you're listening, phone in and give us the answer.
Let us know what's going on here, Adrian.
Ted and Toma, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, how you doing? I just got a quick little thing. About 2 weeks ago, I saw a woodpecker on a tree in our backyard. And this thing was huge, and I thought maybe it really is a pileated or pileated, however you want to say it. So I'm sitting there on the computer. And this thing was huge. It was bigger than a crow with the red crest, and the wood was just flying. It was just pecking away. it was kind of neat. I don't think I'd ever really seen that before. And so I'm on the computer, and it said we were right on the edge of its range as far as coming down into Wisconsin from the east. Is that correct? This is kind of an oddity or what? I've never seen it before or since, but it was there for about 15 minutes.
They're not as unusual as you might think, although they're more often seen than heard. They have an incredibly loud call, and the pairs talk to each other back and forth, and you can hear them for a long distance.
Yeah.
And, I would actually say it's unusual for me to spend a day in the woods around Kemp Station or our cabin in Price County or even out in Iowa County in the Southwest and not hear a pileated calling. You may not see the bird, but, you know, I see them fairly frequently. Mm-hmm. They have a very distinctive woodpecker flight where they flap a few times and dip and flap and go. And once you've seen one once, you never mistake them for anything else. They're big. They're very spectacular. They can really make the wood chips fly like you described. They can open up an incredible hole in a rotten tree in no time. But, you know, they're common enough even around people that I used to deal with lots of woodpecker complaints of damage on home siding and trim and so forth. And in some cases, that was pileateds that were involved. And I'll tell you what, you get one of those suckers latched onto the trim around your dining room windows, pecking away, that gets your attention. And so they're out there, and I would say... you know, I've seen and heard them from north to south and east to west, so yeah. I wouldn't rule out any place where there's big stands of timber and coming across one.
We were lucky at Peninsula State Park one summer, visiting there, and there was a pair with two young. And so we were within feet. And the parents didn't really like the fact that the young ones were, but they stuck around, so we got some wonderful photographs of those pillies.
They're kind of the woody woodpecker of the woodpecker world. But say, Larry, in our last couple of minutes, there were just a couple of things I wanted to remind people of. One is that if you're looking for the turkey hunting season, will be coming up here in mid-April, not too far away. And turkey flocks will be breaking up here shortly with the onset of spring. If you were thinking about turkey hunting, the extra permits that were not distributed during the drawing last fall, or in December, early January, will go on sale March 23rd. And as usual, that will be one zone per day during the course of that week, with I think zone 1 starting on the 23rd, zone 2 on the 24th, and so forth. So if you're looking to get a turkey permit, that's your opportunity. Also remember that our fish and game licenses of all types will expire at the end of this month. It's time to buy new licenses, and don't forget that patron's license.
They just went on.
Larry was out looking for his just a little too early, but
a week early.
I'll be getting mine here maybe this week, and
I'll definitely be getting mine.
Watch out for those licenses on sale. The turkey permit's going on sale, and there are just lots of other things as spring goes along. The county deer committees are back in session, dealing with antlerless harvest permits. The CWD results, the wasting disease results, are out from last fall. A lot of this stuff can be found in some of the publications we've been talking about and on the DNR website.
And I should also mention, I mentioned earlier that I've got Emily, daughter Emily, in the hunter education program or hunter safety program, and I noticed online at the DNR that there are several programs coming up across in various parts of the state. Same kind of program offered around the state and with some openings. So you may want to go to the DNR website and type in hunter education, and that's going to pop up if you're interested in you yourself or a youngster getting them involved. Why, good opportunity.
Yep.
Good opportunity. And Scott, always a pleasure. Boy, we got through a lot. Today,
we did. We plowed a lot of ground, so there were still some other things. One last thing.
Yeah.
The Breeding Bird Atlas, the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, is coming up again for revision and new information. And, boy, this is a terrific opportunity for folks with a leaning toward bird watching and citizen science kind of thing. Go on the website to Breeding Bird Atlas, and you can figure out how or get involved as a volunteer with a survey block. This will document the breeding distribution of Wisconsin birds for everybody to benefit from in terms of the information over the next few years. A neat project, and people can get involved.
Always a pleasure. Scott Craven will be back. Scott Emeritus, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, our guest, and he will be back. We'll visit with him again. It's always a lot of fun. And I always learn something. I bet you do, too. And we're going to learn something tomorrow, too. At 11, Shirley Bauman stops by to talk about how an appraisal can be useful when an insurance claim is necessary. You stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.